This is VOA News, reporting by remote. President-elect Joe Biden's son is facing a federal tax investigation. We get more from AP Washington correspondent Sagar Meghani.
In a statement from his father's transition office, Hunter Biden says he learned yesterday about an investigation into what he calls his tax affairs without giving any details. That renews the spotlight on questions about his financial dealings that plagued Joe Biden's campaign. President Trump has long targeted Hunter Biden, accusing him of profiting off his political connections. The disclosure of the probe comes as the president-elect chooses his cabinet. His attorney general could have oversight of the investigation if it's still ongoing when Joe Biden's sworn in January 20th. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
Federal regulators on Wednesday sued for Facebook as 48 states and districts accused the company in a separate lawsuit of abusing its market power in social networking to crush smaller competitors. We get more from AP's Ed Donahue.
The Federal Trade Commission wants Facebook to sell Instagram and WhatsApp, saying it's trying to eliminate competition. New York Attorney General Letitia James says the states have similar worries.
Unchecked power of corporations who continue to maintain monopoly power by setting the terms for how it uses private data.
The FTC fined Facebook $5 billion last year for privacy violations. James says Facebook needs to be reined in.
Their efforts to suppress innovation, to cut privacy protection, to monetize data.
Facebook says government action punishes successful businesses. Ed Donahue, Washington.
You can find more on these stories and the rest of the day's news at voanews.com. You can also follow us on the VOA mobile app. This is VOA News. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen agreed on Wednesday they have until Sunday to take a firm decision about the future of trade talks. After what the Prime Minister's office said was a frank discussion over dinner in Brussels, the two sides agreed there remained very large gaps between them. In a statement, von der Leyen wrote, "An interesting discussion on the state of play across the list of outstanding issues. We gained a clear understanding of each other's positions. They remain far apart. The talks have stalled over several issues, including fishing rights and competition rules. Britain left the EU on January 31st, but remains in its economic structures until the end of the year. A serious economic rupture could occur January 1st if there is no trade agreement." The Pentagon's initial allotment of coronavirus vaccine will be administered at 16 defense sites in the United States and abroad, with healthcare workers, emergency service personnel, and residents of military retirement homes getting top priority. At a news conference on Wednesday, Assistant Defense Secretary Tom McCaffrey, the Pentagon's health affairs chief, said the DOD will get a small initial vaccine allotment.
At this DOD is expected to receive just under 44,000 doses of the Pfizer vaccine as early as next week for immediate use.
The vaccinations will be voluntary because the Pfizer vaccine initially is to be made available on an emergency use basis. The shots could become mandatory later if vaccines are fully licensed by the Food and Drug Administration. NASA has named 18 astronauts to train for its Artemis moon landing program. AP correspondent Mike Gracia has details.
48 years after astronaut Gene Cernan was the last man to walk on the moon, NASA announces plans for a return. 18 astronauts were named Wednesday to train for NASA's Artemis moon landing program. Among them, Shell Lindgren.
There are many times in this job where you have kind of pinch me moments.
Nine of the astronauts named to the Artemis program are women, including Kayla Barron.
We're actually going to build a small space station that's going to orbit the moon, and we can fly Orion to the Gateway and then get on our lander from there.
NASA's aiming to land a man and woman on the moon by 2024. I'm Mike Gracia.
Commercial flights with the Boeing 737 MAX jetliners resumed Wednesday for the first time since they were grounded. Brazil's Gol Airlines is set to start regular service on December 18th with several daily flights between Sao Paulo and other major Brazilian cities. Reporting by remote, I'm David Burr.
America. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty, Washington. Today is Thursday, December 10th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Ghanaian President Nana Akufo-Addo is re-elected to a second term.
On the basis of the foregoing election results, and by the power vested in me as the chairperson of the Electoral Commission of Ghana, it is my duty and honor to declare Nana Akufo-Addo as president elect of the Republic of Ghana.
We'll talk with VOA's Peter Clarté in Accra on the challenges confronting the new president-elect. Zimbabwe's parliament urges the government to resume rescue efforts at a collapsed mine. Police brutality is a concern globally on this Human Rights Day today, Thursday. And Ethiopia's prime minister visits Kenya to talk trade and security.
We cannot establish an economic victory if we are consistently also going to be having security challenges. So we must work together as two neighbors to deal with those elements who threaten the peace and the stability of both Kenya and Ethiopia.
And child trafficking is on the rise in Mali. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Ghanaian President Nana Akufo-Addo is declared the winner of that country's presidential and parliamentary elections held Monday this week. Here is Electoral Commission Chairperson Jean Adukwe Mesa with the announcement.
At the end of a transparent, fair, orderly, and timely and peaceful presidential election, the total number of valid votes cast was 13,434,574, representing 79% of the total registered voters. At the end of the polls, Nana Addo-Dankwa Akufo-Addo of the New Patriotic Party obtained 6,730,413 votes, being 51.595% of the total valid votes cast. John Dramani Mahama of the National Democratic Congress obtained 6,214,889 votes, being 47.366% of the total valid votes cast. Distinguished ladies and gentlemen, currently the election results we have declared exclude that of the Techiman South constituency, which has a total voter population of 128,018. The said election results are not ready because they are being contested. It is important to note, however, that the difference between the total number of votes between the first and second candidates is 515,524 votes. As a result, if we were to add the 128,018 full results to the results of the second candidate, it would not change the outcome of the election. Distinguished ladies and gentlemen, on the basis of the foregoing election results, and by the power vested in me as the chairperson of the Electoral Commission of Ghana and the returning officer of the presidential election, it is my duty and honor to declare Nana Addo-Dankwa Akufo-Addo as president-elect of the Republic of Ghana. May God bless our homeland, Ghana, and make our nation great and strong. Let peace reign.
That was Ghana's Electoral Commission Chairperson, Jean Adukwe Mesa. VOA's Peter Clarté, who is on assignment in the Ghanaian capital, Accra, says there is jubilation from supporters of the ruling New Patriotic Party, the NPP, of the re-election of President Nana Akufo-Addo, and disappointment from supporters of main opposition candidate and former President John Dramani Mahama.
Well, there's two different reactions. For supporters of the NPP, they are very happy. They were honking their car horns. They were blowing vuvuzelas. They were jubilating in the street, particularly at Nima, here in Accra, where the president's personal residence is. The main opposition, National Democratic Congress, let me put it this way, they are not happy with the results. They thought that there were some concerns that were not properly addressed, and that is why they have not reacted positively to the re-election of incumbent president Nana Addo-Dankwa Akufo-Addo.
Peter, the election must have been a very close one, given the winning percentage of nearly 52%.
Well, James, it is. But in the regular Ghanaian political climate, although it is close, it is wide as well, because the president won with at least 600,000 votes, which is no mean feat. Now, the ruling party, before they won the first round of election 4 years ago, they won with 1 million votes. That is what they said. This time around, it's about 600,000 plus votes.
The main opposition candidate and the former president, John Mahama, has he considered, because a day after the election, he has served a warning to the government not to steal the election.
Well, he has yet to concede. Other opposition leaders called to congratulate Nana Addo-Dankwa Akufo-Addo, looking at the trajectory of the results that were certified by the Electoral Commission. Some officials that I spoke with late last night were telling me that they are not conceding. They were going to fight it. I don't know how. Probably they might go the legal route. Nobody knows. But we will talk to them again to find out their next line of action. But so far, the former president has yet to concede that he lost the election fair and square.
Peter, what do you see as some of the challenges for President-elect Akufo-Addo as he gets set to begin his second term?
One key thing a lot of people are talking about here is the impact of the COVID-19 on the economy, which slowed. It forced the president to close the borders. Businesses were slowed. So that is one thing that he has to deal with. And then the other challenge is to unite the country, because anytime there's an election, there's a winner, there's a loser. You need to reach out, you know, probably try to smoke the peace pipe and then reconcile the two parties, you know, to come up and join together to build the nation up. Those are the two main challenges that a political analyst here in Accra told me when I spoke with them about some of the challenges that he faces.
What can you tell us, Peter, about this report, quoting the Ghanaian police, that at least five people were killed in the election-related violence?
Well, those are isolated cases, because overall, the country was peaceful. There were a few skirmishes here and there. The police are investigating the circumstances leading to the death of these individuals.
Thank you so much, Peter. And we look forward to speaking with you again tomorrow on this program.
Thank you. Thank you.
That was VOA's Peter Clotty on assignment in Accra, Ghana, covering that country's presidential and parliamentary elections. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta and visiting Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed have inaugurated the Moyale one-stop border post to boost cross-border trade between the two countries. The two leaders also inaugurated the 500-kilometer Hawassa-Hagere-Mariam-Moyale Road, which is part of the Trans-Africa Highway and a key segment of the Mombasa-Nairobi-Addis Ababa Transport Corridor. Atieno Odhiambo reports from Nairobi.
Speaking to residents of Moyale Town on the Ethiopian side of the border, President Kenyatta encouraged traders from both countries to utilize the new one-stop border post to boost cross-border trade. He said the region has huge untapped potential for trade and investment. The president also spoke about cross-border insecurity in the region, saying both Kenya and Ethiopia will not relent in their efforts to ensure lasting peace and tranquility along their common border.
What we want is to see a deepening of the integration between our two countries. And you, the people who live this border, the people of Kenya here in Moyale, the people of Ethiopia here in Moyale, have a central role to play to strengthen that relationship, that partnership. We want to see Moyale becoming the Dubai of this whole region. And we must also work together, because we cannot establish an economic victory if we are consistently also going to be having security challenges. So we must work together as two neighbors to deal with those elements who live in and amongst us and who threaten the peace and the stability of both Kenya and Ethiopia.
Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said the new Moyale one-stop border post will help to hasten movement of goods and persons across the Kenya-Ethiopia border. The Prime Minister also echoed President Kenyatta's sentiments that Kenya and Ethiopia will continue working together to develop the infrastructure while maintaining peace and security along the border region.
It is a great joy for me to witness that we are one people, one family into two countries with artificial border. This new infrastructure will bring the two family which is living in two countries to come together and to tap untapped potential and lots of opportunity on business, economy, and so many other social aspects, including tourism. Just like the infrastructure, we should work on peace and security of this area. If we could eliminate Al-Shabaab and OLA from this region, you can see how these people can be transformed into one family, one country, one people.
Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed is on a two-day official visit to Kenya, his first foreign trip since he announced the completion of a military operation in the northern Tigray region of his country. His visit is intended to improve the volume of trade between the two countries by easing immigration and customs clearance. President Kenyatta and his visiting Ethiopian counterpart will today, Thursday, travel to Lamu County, where they will inspect the ongoing construction of Lamu Port, which, when completed, will link Kenya, Ethiopia, and South Sudan. Atieno Odhiambo, VOA Daybreak Africa, in Nairobi, Kenya.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Thursday, December 10th. Zimbabwe's parliament has called on the government to resume rescue efforts at a mine that collapsed 2 weeks ago, trapping at least 10 miners underground. Authorities had called off rescue efforts on December 5th after pulling six miners from the shaft. But the Zimbabwe Miners Federation says as many as 40 people could still be trapped. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
Parliament's Mines Committee Wednesday said it wanted the government to resume searching for miners trapped underground on November 25th when the Ren gold mine in the Bindura district north of Harare collapsed. Lawmakers summoned Winston Chitando, the Minister of Mines and Mining Development, to answer questions about the situation. There have been no signs of life from the mine, and over the weekend, the government called off the search and rescue mission, deeming it risky. Settlement Chikwinya is one of the lawmakers not happy with that decision.
Is that why are we as a nation quick to condemn? Surely a shaft of 60 meters, are we that much shallow in our engineering approach that every time there is a shaft collapse of 60 meters, we condemn it to be a grave?
Chitando was non-committal on whether the government would resume the search mission. He said there are many factors affecting the search of the trapped miners,
which include but are not limited to our preparedness. There was reference to the equipment, to have the adequate equipment.
The government says 10 miners were trapped in the cave-in. The Miners Federation and relatives of missing miners say the number is closer to 40. The Center for Natural Resource Governance, an NGO that advocates for good governance of natural resources, particularly minerals, says Chitando must be pushed further. Henry Nyapokoto is the organization's program manager. He says this is not the first time that the government has abandoned trapped small-scale miners.
This has been a huge problem in the gold mining sector, especially this year, 2020. Our biggest concern as an organization and as civic society is to have the government as the mining regulator to address the root cause of mining disasters that are currently claiming lives of artisanal miners.
There have been at least four fatal mining accidents in Zimbabwe over the past 2 years. Most miners in Zimbabwe work for themselves, selling whatever valuable minerals they find to the government. Gold represents Zimbabwe's biggest foreign exchange earner. Many miners took up the profession because they have no other way to make a living in Zimbabwe's moribund economy. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
Today is International Human Rights Day, and experts say police violence has increased dramatically in Africa as most officers are used by their respective governments to enforce COVID-19 guidelines. Kenya is among the countries where security agencies have used brutal means to keep people off the streets since March this year. As Marie Ojiambo reports from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, human rights organizations have expressed concern about the excessive use of force by the police.
This year's Human Rights Day focuses on the devastating fallout of COVID-19 pandemic on the underprivileged people, children, women, and the need to build back better by ensuring human rights are central to recovery efforts. However, in Kenya and some of the African countries, COVID-19 pandemic has come with police brutality as governments were trying to enhance law and order by using the police to execute the Ministry of Health guidelines. Hilton Irungu, Executive Director, Amnesty International Kenya, said that police officers, while enforcing the COVID-19 guidelines, they shot, killed, and also injured members of the public, hence threatening the right of people to life.
Brutal in the sense that for the first time in living memory, a very small virus threatened not just our health, but also our very right to life. We've seen a number of cases as Amnesty of citizens who were brutalized by police officers, either shot or beaten, or either not wearing masks or being out after curfew hours. Public outcry, particularly from around June to July, has actually brought those numbers down. But I think the important thing for human rights organizations is that every life has to be protected, and for that reason we continue to demand for safety and dignity of all Kenyans.
According to the Kenya National Commission of Human Rights, justice has not been served to most of the police brutality victims. Mr. Irungu, however, said that most of the police violence cases takes long before justice is served to victims.
We have seen cases of interdictions, unfortunately not as many as we would have liked to have seen. But of course, in the Kenyan context, it can be between 2 to 4 years before justice is finally delivered through a court judgment. And I think for the impact on the families, really, it is traumatizing and sad period for them because they know that it will take years before they get to know what actually happened to their children or to their parents.
On the other hand, the Human Rights Watch has criticized the excessive use of violence by the police. The Human Rights Watch senior researcher on Africa, Otieno Namwaya, said that some victims receive threats and intimidations from the police.
The biggest problem really is the lack of government appetite to even ensure that some of those issues are properly investigated. And I think because government doesn't seem to care, police actually think they're okay. They can go ahead, do whatever they want to do because they will get away with it. So I think the biggest issue is the lack of interest in even investigating and prosecuting the cases.
According to the civil societies in Kenya, more than 20 people have died in the hands of the police and hundreds injured between March to November this year. The Kenya Police, through the spokesperson Charles Owino, said that in cases where the police used force, members of the public were chaotic. Earlier, Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta and the Interior Ministry said that all reports of violence would be investigated and dealt with accordingly, a move that Kenyans are yet to see. The Human Rights Watch says that police brutality thrives more in Kenya between the curfew hours. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
Experts at the United Nations Refugees Agency, the UNHCR, say child trafficking is on the rise in Mali due to ongoing conflict and COVID-19 socioeconomic impacts. With schools still closed because of insecurity, COVID-19, and teacher strikes, children in the West African country are more susceptible than previous years, says Marie-Emily Dozen, a protection officer with UNHCR in Mali. Dozen spoke to Ricky Stryak about the thousands of young people who have been trafficked into forced labor.
We have monitoring mechanisms in place, and we've been able to collect and to document a large number of incidents and human rights violations. And in particular, we've been unfortunately very concerned with the rise of serious violations of child's rights, and particularly recruitment and trafficking. And it's true that it's issues that were pre-existing COVID, but the situation of the pandemic has really increased the vulnerability of children to those risks. And in terms of children's rights, we have really noticed that with the closure of schools, and also the fact that the socioeconomic conditions of family has deteriorated, we have seen that this has added another layer of issues for people in Mali, but particularly for children.
Can you tell me a bit more about how the conflict in the north of the country, and really in the middle of the country as well, I believe, is making the situation even worse?
Well, in the north and in the center, you have a climate of insecurity and violence, which is marked by the presence of armed groups. And it's actually the activities of those armed groups that has really added another layer of complexity in the situation in Mali, and particularly children and young people who are being, you know, facing higher risk of being recruited and being used by those armed groups. We have seen, for example, higher instance of recruitment because there is a rivalry between armed groups for the control of resources, the control of territory, so that it has generated the search for new recruits.
According to your report, there were an estimated 6,000 children, disproportionately boys, working across 8 mining sites in the country this year. So can you tell me more about the forced labor?
Yeah, child are being used in gold mines, particularly in the region of Gao and Kidal. Those are areas that are controlled by armed groups. So the armed groups are trafficking children for labor in gold mines. And I think the situation is extremely complex because those areas are really under the control of the armed group, and there is very little presence of the state. So the state has limited control over those gold mines and how they are managed. So we have done, protection actors have done a protection assessment, and they have found an estimated 6,000 children, mainly boys, working across 8 mine sites. And they are exposed to the worst form of child labor, economic exploitation, but also physical, sexual, and psychological abuse.
That was Marie-Emily Dozen, a protection officer with UNHCR in Mali. She was speaking to Ricky Stryer from the Malian capital, Bamako. And that's it for this Thursday, December 10th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barton in Washington, hoping that you will have a very good day.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band.